that's okay with you, Jay? Yeah, sure, please, keep doing what you're doing over there. And thank you very much for arranging the bagel, that's great, appreciate that. This is the House Oil and Gas Meeting, Special Committee on Oil and Gas it is. Today is Monday, the 19th of March. It is now 8:33 PM, or AM, excuse me. I'm not used to these morning meetings. With us, we have Representatives Dugan, Kawasaki, Ramris, Samuels, and myself, I, the Chair of the Committee, Corring. And we're here to hear again from the administration. We did our presentation, our general overview, and did all our questions the last couple of meetings. And now what we want to do is get into the sectional analysis so that we can hear a more detailed breakdown as to various sections within the AGEA legislation before us. We've also been joined by Representative Olson. Thank you, Kurt, for being here. And in the audience, Bob Roses. Bob, you're, I don't think there's a place for you up here. You're welcome to join us for the time being until these seats get filled here. I'd like to also note that we're going to quite possibly, depending on how it goes here, continue with this sectional analysis tomorrow. And then on Wednesday, we have scheduled the joint public hearing with resources. Our preference, of course, would be to have the presentations and the, not necessarily presentations per se, but testimony from the oil industry on the legislation, but it hasn't quite worked out that way. We're getting the cart before the horse just a little bit, but we want to keep this process going as quickly as we can and cover as much ground as we can. So we're going to proceed with the public hearing with the Senate Finance Committee on Wednesday. And then hopefully by the end of this week, perhaps on Friday, Jim?
Perhaps.
Perhaps. We're being as optimistic as we can. We're going to have some oil industry testimony. And then on Saturday, we're going to have a continuation of the public testimony with the Senate Finance. So with that outline having been presented, I'd like to start with Bonnie Harris, who's here with the Department of Law. She's going to present the sectional analysis that's been prepared by the by her department. And so you're Bonnie, right?
No. Nope.
Oh, Bonnie.
Yeah, this is Marcia Davis.
Oh, this is Marcia Davis,
the
right.
Deputy Commissioner.
I'm sorry. I was actually given that note here, and I'm sorry for getting your name, Marcia. So we have Marcia Davis and Pat Galvin here in Juneau to present the analysis, and we have Bonnie Harris, who's online from the Department of Law in Anchorage, in case we have any questions as we go along. So Pat and Marcia, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. We're pleased to be able to present the sectional analysis of the Alaska Gasoline Inducement Act, and we'll begin. This act introduces a new chapter to Title 43 of the tax code. It's Title 90, or Chapter 90 of Title 43. Article 1 of this new chapter is entitled Inducement to Construction of a Natural Gas Pipeline in this State. And like all good statutes, we begin with a purpose. Section 43.90.010 states that the purpose of this act is to encourage expedited construction of the gas line and lists four different goals. The goals are North Slope gas commercialization, the promotion of exploration on the North Slope, the maximization of benefits for the people of the state of Alaska from the development of the oil and gas, and it encourages the commitment of natural gas to that North Slope pipeline. Article 2 is entitled the Alaska Gasoline Inducement Act License. This section of the act focuses on the license portion of the bill. Section 43.90.100 is entitled Gas Project, and this essentially outlines that the Department of Revenue and Department of Natural Resource Commissioners will award the Alaska Gasoline Inducement Act License, and the person that receives that license receives the inducements that are further set forth in this article. 43.90.110. Oh, yes.
I forgot to mention to the committee that any questions that the committee has as we go along, feel free just to jump right in, okay? So, Representative Samuels?
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify, it's a license, not, you can't issue multiple licenses.
That's correct. It's a license.
Thank you.
43.90.110 outlines the inducement to be given to the licensee, and the inducements are listed in items 1, 2, and 3. Item 1 is the state matching contribution Yes.
I'll wait, you're through.
Okay. Item one is the state matching contribution, which is not to exceed $500 million, paid out over a five-year period. Period commences on the date of issuance of the license. And the matching terms for that matching contribution are listed in A and B. Under A, the matching criteria are specified prior to open season as being an equal match, 50-50, for licensees' qualified expenditures. After the close of the open season, the match is not specified but left at, to be specified in the license, which means that it is a criteria to be resolved in the bidding process and the issuance of the license, the award of the license. However, we do state that there is a limit on the state's match of 80%, so the state's match cannot exceed 80% in the post-open season section. We further define in Section C what qualified expenditures are, and they are costs that are incurred after the license is issued. So this bill is not intended to reimburse people for costs that were incurred prior to the issuance of the license. Those costs need to be directly and reasonably related to the cost of obtaining a FERC or RCA certificate. And they specifically do not include overhead costs, litigation costs, assets or work product predating the issuance of the license, or civil or criminal penalties or fines. The second inducement provided to the licensee is the benefit of the Alaska Gasoline Inducement Act Coordinator, whose duties are more fully specified in AS 4390-330. And finally, the licensee receives the benefits of a state program that will provide training for employment for those that will be the employment workforce that will be needed for the construction of a pipeline. Any questions on that?
We've been joined by Representative Bellspin. Thank you, Nancy. Good to see you. Representative Samuel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Marcia. The money, total amount of money between now and an open season of the $500 million, or that's total money spent between now and an open season is going to be what, as opposed to between an open season and a certification?
We have not split it out. We have gotten estimates, and it could be as low as $50 million, as high as $200 million is the range that we've been...
Total, not our end, but total.
No, total. So our half of that cost would be as low as $25 million, as high as $100 million is the expected range.
Okay, and I'll let some of those go, but then I have a philosophical question for you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under 4390-110-3, it says the benefits of the state program to provide training, et cetera. Mm-hmm. What state program is that?
That is a reference to later in the bill. Let me find it here. And Bonnie, if you're online and see it before I do, please call it out.
While Marcia's looking up for the direct references, I'm Pat Galvin, Commissioner of Revenue. Representative Dugan, right now we don't have a program set up. The intent is to work with the Department of Education, the university system, Department of Labor, to establish that with the licensee so that it's geared towards the jobs that would likely fall out of a pipeline project that would include not only the construction jobs but also the other jobs, engineering, design, accounting, those other opportunities that would present themselves with this project coming in. So what we're providing for here is primarily an assurance to the licensee that a training program will be developed. It will be developed with their project in mind, and it will be in place in time to have people ready for the jobs when they become available.
Representative Dugan, through the chair, I think I'm thinking of a section that had more detail that did not survive the later draft. So I think this is the sole reference.
when that job program is commissioned out.
Mr. Madugan?
So the intention of the Palin administration is to develop a program that will train Alaskans to work to build the gas pipeline. Is there any kind of timeline on that?
I believe there was a fiscal note that was developed from the Department of Labor that set out.
There hadn't been yet. It's still being developed. Okay. Where you'll be, that'll be available hopefully within the next week or so in terms of what the expected program is going to be. But the answer to your question is yes, that's the intent. And the intent is to, again, we don't know what the time frame is going to be necessarily for the overall project. We don't know if the open season is going to be in the first year, if it's going to be at the third year, whether the FERC application is going to be in the third year, the fifth year. So some of the expected, the schedule for the training program is going to be somewhat based upon reflection of the applications that we get in. But the intent is to have the program in place and ready to go once the jobs are available.
Yes.
Thank you. Just one more question. Do you anticipate that you're going to be able to establish that program without legislation, or do you think you're going to be bringing legislation forward at some point for
this program? Yeah, at this point, we haven't identified any particular hurdles to bringing it that would need additional legislation, but again, we're still working with those departments to identify what hurdles there may be. So,
but the Sergeant's Chair, but you need funding for it.
We will need funding for it. Yes.
Thank you.
Well, Representative Samuels.
Thank you. Thank you. I got two scenarios for you. If we go to an open season and we've paid our $25 to $100 million to kind of boost it along to an open season. If the open season is successful and you have enough gas bid to get financing, why would we spend another nickel after the open season when we've got Wall Street money and we've got the producers' money then to do that?
And that's something that we're actually putting into the opportunity for the proposals to dictate. So what we anticipate is if we receive a proposal, it's going to say that we're going to spend X amount to get to an open season. And then if we have a successful open season, then we're going to split the cost this way. And it could be 100% pipeline company, zero for the state. If we have an unsuccessful, then we're going to split it this way. We will take those and then evaluate the value to the state based upon what we expect the likelihood of hitting those different scenarios are. So the proposaler, the company that's providing the proposal, will be inclined to make it as attractive as possible, and if they see little risk for the project if we have a successful open season and little reason for the state to have to put in additional money, they would want to boost the value of their proposal in the eyes of the state by doing just what you said, having the state not have to contribute.
Okay, and my second scenario, of course, is the worst scenario, where you don't get enough gas bid to build a gas pipeline or to get financing for a gas pipeline. And then if you end up with a proposal that says spending 80%, we continue through the unsuccessful open season, we design, get all the permits for a pipeline with no customers, and we're spending up to 80% of the money, why wouldn't we spend 100% of the money so that when you get to the certification process, if you think this thing has value, why would we spend 80% of the money and give it to Mid-America or TransCanada or Conoco TransCanada? We have a thing of value, which we just paid for it. So if you have an unsuccessful open season, why do you need them anymore? Why, your licensee failed you.
Well, they didn't fail you because an initial open season is not a failure necessarily of the licensee. It's a situation at that particular moment where we have not yet overcome the hurdles that the producers or others have identified that are keeping them from participating in this project. And to get from an open season to FERC certificate requires also a tremendous amount of expertise to get from that point to the actual certificate. We need the company there to actually do the work and get that certificate. It's not something that we can just do on our own.
If I could, mm-hmm. could you, I mean, if you're spending, like I said, once again, you're spending 80% of the money on the highest risk part,
You don't have a customer. You're designing it, and you're...
Well, you're presuming the 80%. The 80% is the maximum that they could ask the state to share. We don't know what that number is going to be until we get the proposals.
But assuming that you allow them to get up to 80%, going to 100% and just hiring somebody, because then when you get to the end of the day, if you have the certificate, you have something of value. You have something of value that you can sell it to the producers in exchange for the gas. You could sell it back to Mid-America. You certainly make your money back. If it has value and it becomes a successful open season, you've now paid for something, and you're not going to get your money back.
Well, that's,
opposed to just, you've got it in your hand, we're paying for it anyway.
Well, we will get our money back. I mean, we've talked about how we get our money back at the end of, by getting to that point. So it's not a question of getting our money back, just a question, I think, where you are going is whether we have the opportunity to further maximize what the state might get back. But what you have to recognize is that we have to try to get somebody in the door initially. And if they look at this process and they say, if we get to an open season and it's unsuccessful, then the state's going to kick us out the door and bring in somebody else and drive the rest of the way under some other scenario, then it's going to be less likely that we're going to get somebody in initially. We're locking in a relationship at the time the proposal is made that's going to carry us all the way through to that FERC certificate, and we're together on this to get to that end goal. And if we change that dynamic to where they say, or we tell them, look, everything is on you to get to a successful open season, and then we will leave you past there, that's a different dynamic, and we're happy to talk about it. And you know, we clearly have thought through the various scenarios and what would maximize our opportunity for success, and we ended up concluding, based upon conversations with the different company representatives and playing through how...
Which companies?
Well, we talked to, as we've talked before, on the pipeline side, primarily TransCanada, Mid-American, Enbridge. We talked with the producer. We talked to the explorers. We've talked with some of the folks who represent consumers down in the lower 48. And what we recognized in designing this sort of risk sharing between the state and the companies is we need to provide them with the opportunity to see a successful end product. And if we cut them off at open season, then their attractiveness of engaging in this at the initial phase becomes much lower.
They would be enthused about a successful open season.
They would be enthused about a successful open season, but they also would be taking the risk that if they have an unsuccessful open season, they're out 100%. They're gone.
I don't believe the whole point on this ongoing debate. It's going to be ongoing for the next 3 months. But what do you do if there's a second unsuccessful open season? And now we've spent 50% and we've spent 80%, and you have yet a second unsuccessful open season, or you get half the gas bid, not enough to pay, then... Where do we end up? I mean, is there a third phase where, I mean, we're stuck in bed with this person who isn't getting the job done?
And there's
perhaps I should have rephrased that.
Moving off the analogy, I think that clearly what we can't anticipate where we're ultimately going to hit that success point where we get the commitments, we get the financing for this project. What we're trying to do in setting up the chain of events that will follow through on AGEA is to continue as we move forward to increase the ultimate likelihood of success. That's really the best that we can hope for at this point, because there's no path that has been identified to us that leads to a guarantee of success at the end of the day. And so what we're trying to do through the AGEA process is to make sure that as we move forward and as the state continues to participate in this process, that forward movement is going to continue to make it more likely to succeed than not. And so at the end of the day, it is possible through all the different chains of events that could take place that we could end up in a situation where we have a FERC certificate in hand and we still have an unsuccessful open season. At that point, then we'll again look at our alternatives. We have a project in hand. We've got set terms, whatever they may be at that particular time. And at this point, given what we have seen in terms of the analysis of the project, we would expect at that time to have a project that is economic. It's economic for all potential participants, and then it's just a matter of making sure that that is clearly conveyed and that the participants recognize it's there to their advantage to participate. And at this point, that's the clearest path that we can see to increasing the chances of success.
Okay. I'm joined by Representative Gardner. Berta, good morning. Thanks for being here. Questions from Representative Ramis, followed by Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioner. Good morning. Nice to see you both again. To recap so that I have a clear frame of reference on this discussion and on Representative Samuel's point, my perception is two extraordinarily valuable commodities, time, money. With the proposal that we had before us last year, the Governor Murkowski's proposal, it was what we saw go through the hourglass was a lot of time with a very uncertain outcome. The question of an open season, the question of due diligence, the question mark hung over the producers in that regard with the commodity of time. This AGEA program, Commissioner, I perceive is much more having the legislature authorize, like a board of directors, if you will, would authorize, say, I was just hearing this morning, a publicly traded company had authorized an $8 billion share buyback program. But that horizon for spending that $8 billion is over a broadly specified period of time. It's not in 3 months, it's over many years, and they are not subject on any given day to spend any increment of those dollars. They have a lot of subjectivity insofar as their ability to spend that money. So my perception is that what we're doing is we're swapping the question mark that hung over the time component last year, which would led to an unknown outcome because there was no standard, there was no finish line, if you will, in the process. And yet the state spent no money. So it kept its money, but it put its time at risk. And what AGEA seems to do is to swap those two commodities, that we are setting an egg timer, and there is now a pretty well-defined period that takes us to an outcome, and yet at the end of that outcome there's an open season and we don't know what's going to transpire at the outcome. But in order to do that, we have to spend some money, and so the legislature would authorize the spending of up to $500 million. We don't know how much of that would actually be spent over the time horizon, and we still have an uncertain outcome. But the question is that at the end of this phase, how many variables are left unanswered? And the legislature concluded, under Governor Murkowski's plan, that there were far too many unanswered questions. There was no established timeline. There was no finish line that was put into statute with the Stranded Gas Act. And yet with the AGEA, what we're doing is we are creating a finish line, and the uncertainty is whether the producers will cross over that finish line with us, whether they will honor moving our hydrocarbon molecules that are stranded on the North Slope over that finish line and take it to market once we have created an environment. But it strikes me that the whole philosophical approach to AGEA is that we swap the unknown of time for a finite amount of time. We seed that with our money, a non-specified amount up to and not to exceed $500 million dollar for dollar. And then we have to wait and see whether the producers are good faith partners or whether the state has a deeper problem, which is that we did not hook up our horse and wagon to people that actually want to move gas from the North Slope to a market to create a viable second income stream for the state of Alaska. Is that a pretty accurate read of what we're discussing this morning?
I think it is an accurate description. I think the couple points I'd just like to add on to that is, while the initial legislation is similar to what you described with a board of directors saying here's the money to spend to buy back shares over some period of time, there is that interim step that wouldn't exist in the analogy described that we have here, where a year from now the legislature will see the schedule for that expenditure and we'll have the opportunity to say no, that's not going to work for us, and that's something that we need to recognize, that there is that opportunity that we will all know what the schedule is coming year from now once a licensee is selected. Other than that, I think you captured an accurate description.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you. Representative Dugan, followed by
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of, I hope, quick questions. So when you were thinking about the system and how it would work under this bill, at what point do you come to the legislature for the $500 million?
Right now what our intent is to ask that the $300 million that was set aside last year that was put in Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's fund for gas line related purposes, that be redesignated for this purpose. What we would anticipate is that money will get us through the initial proposal process. It'll get us through the open season. It'll take us for a number of years. Between now and the time, and a year from now, we will have a proposal that will actually lay out the expenditure timeline, what they ultimately expect to expend and what they ultimately are expecting the state to expend. Again, we don't know if they're going to come in and ask for the entire $500 million and what contingencies there may be. It may be, as we talked earlier, that they're going to have a break-off point that if they have a successful open season, then they might not ask the state for any additional monies. I think at this point, what we're saying is let's put the $300 million, redesignate it for GS purposes, and then hold that for a while and see if we do need any additional funds, but that will come later on down the road.
So $300 million this session, is that what?
It's taking the $300 million that was set aside last year and redesignating it for this purpose so it's held for that purpose as opposed to what
right.
It was before.
But this session?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And just mm-hmm. another, I hope, related question. So this is a system that imagines that you'll have a number of people who want the license, that they will bid from zero of that extra money to 80% of that extra money. That's the range of the potential amounts that they might want, right?
Well, it's okay if I just the maximum they're going to ask for is the $500 million. What changes, the 80% changes, is how much is going to come out of their pocket, how much is going to come out of the state pocket as we move forward. And so it's not that they're going to ask for 80% of the $500 million, it's just they're going to ask for
80%
of the expenditure.
I'm sorry, thank you. And one of the seven criteria that are listed in 170 is what percentage they ask you to cover. So my question to you is, how important is that criterion compared to the others listed in 170?
And when we get to the evaluation, as we talked at the last hearing, the two primary drivers are value to the state and likelihood of success. On value to the state, that's a number of different metrics will probably be used, and one of the drivers is going to be net present value to the state. And under that evaluation, the amount that the state has to actually expend is going to be a significant factor in what that present value, net present value, is. If they're only asking for us to put somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 million into the open season, then we may end up not having to put anything more. And another proposal is saying that we want you to expend the $500 million either way, then that will factor into how the economics of it to the state will ultimately look. I think we're not necessarily, and part of that also goes to the likelihood of success. I mean, if they are coming in and saying, at this point, you know, we're a go. We're going to take this all the way to certificate, and we expect the state to put in this amount at this point and less if we get here, but they're putting in a substantial amount of their own money into the process, then that will also go to how likely we are to succeed in the end, because they're showing a true commitment to do what it takes on their end to make it work. So it's kind of a dual factor in how we look at this in terms of how much they're expecting to basically get by on the state's money and how much the state money just moves them along.
Dugan?
Well, I just want to point out something that I'll probably be pointing out until this bill leaves, which is if I'm the bidder and I'm looking at these criteria, I'm going to want to know how much they're worth, because it's going to change the way I'm going to make this bid. If I'm a legislator and I'm attempting to evaluate the award after the fact, I'm going to want to know how much of each of these was worth, because it's really the only way I've got to evaluate the award, whether or not it matched how this was assessed by the people who are going to be making the award. And as long as these seven criteria are not rated, one of them might be worth 1% and one of them might be worth 80%, and I don't know that, I'm having a hard time figuring out how I'm going to evaluate that in any real way. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think that's a very fair request, and I think it's incumbent on us as we go through this legislative process to describe for you in more detail and to provide you with a bit more information in terms of how that objective economic evaluation is going to take place, how those factors, and I think that when you get down to how the money's going to be split, it does end up being an objective part of this criteria, because you can figure out the economics fairly with a straightforward number crunching. But also those provisions that go to the likelihood of success and the judgment that goes into making that evaluation, we have to, I think, give you a bit more information on that. I think that's pretty clear from our discussions.
Mm-hmm. Representative Alstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My comments go back to comments that were made by Representative Ramirez. First of all, I just want to say I appreciate also the commitment from the commissioner that you will get back with us on continued information on the criteria rating. I think that's extremely important. But pertaining to what Representative Ramirez talked about and the trade-off of time versus money, money versus time, the conversations that I have had with the different folks that have been mentioned, you know, TransCanada and Bridge America, different people in the lower 48 and in other countries, is that their feelings are that they feel good about how this is set up, and that is that not only do we want a true commitment, but they want to know that there's a true and actual commitment from us as a state. And the folks that I have talked to feel that this makes them a lot more secure in wanting to come out and make their commitments to us. You know, it is very real. What's more valuable, time versus money or whatever? But my conversations are they have stated flat out that they are more willing to come to the table and more willing to put their commitments on the plate, knowing that we are doing the same. So I definitely see the value in that. Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. You're right in Olson.
Do you have a contingency plan for the $500 million if that $300 million that's parked in Alaska Housing is not available?
Well, a contingency plan, we're dependent on the legislature to provide us with the funds. I'm not sure what you mean by contingency plan. We're going to ask you for the money. We think that the $300 million provides the cleanest opportunity to just say, here's the funds available for this process. It's already been set aside. It's not taking money out of the current budget. And it's the most straightforward mechanism to fund this process on for a number of years into the future. As far as a contingency plan, it would just be asking you for the money.
Do you know the history on the $300 million?
Not intimately, no.
It was taken off the table so the previous administration wouldn't spend it down, and that's why it was parked in Alaska Housing.
I think that it would be a good thing to talk about. There's a different interpretation from the other folks that...
I would stand corrected by anybody at the table if that was... if I was confused last year, but...
They're not going to get away from the $500 million that quickly. Mm-hmm. To Representative Dugan's point on the criteria, how do you handle right now all the potential bidders that ask a question about the $500 million, both you and Commissioner Irwin? I mean, the way that it is right now, the two of you are going to go into a room and make a decision on this thing. So how do you answer the very specific question? So how are you going to rate this? I mean, I assume these people have to ask. Do you answer the same question? Is it publicly? Do you answer it in writing? Do you have... make sure that everybody hears the same exact answer to that extremely important question. Where in the rating is this the amount of the $500 million?
Well, we tell everybody the same thing that we've told you, which is that it, again, comes down to that objective economic analysis of value to the state, and then it goes to how much information are you giving us to give us a sense of confidence that you're actually going to succeed at delivering on that economic promise. So beyond that, what we recognize, the discussions have been similar to what we had here. We'd like to see more specificity. We'd like to see more predictability in terms of what the outcome's going to be if we shape our proposal in a particular way. And our response is the same as what you've heard, which is that we're trying to balance a desire to provide a level of expectation in terms of what type of a proposal is going to win favor with us versus how another one will lose value in our eyes. But we're not looking at going to the more weighted, specified, this is going to get 30% of your score, this is going to get 40% of your score, for the reasons that we discussed last time.
Okay, I just.
So they're getting the same answer.
I wanted to bring out in public, if I am Hickam, one of the producers, one of the explorers, one of the pipe co's, and they're all asking the same question to get exactly the same answer, exactly the same phrase almost, which almost excludes you and Commissioner Irwin from having conversations with them, which isn't practical. But, I mean, I would something that I would be very cognizant of if I were you, having a conversation with Mid-America, and then a week goes by and you have the same exact question asked you with TransCanada, and a turn of a phrase is a different thing on how they perceive this. Is, I mean, if,
in the end,
I don't know how to answer it.
I recognize exactly where you see the concern, and I share that concern in terms of giving anybody a sense of an unfair advantage or having a different understanding of the issue. Where we have been up to now is we've made it clear that the discussions that we've had is about what we're going to put into the bill, and what comes out of the legislative process is going to be the rules that we're going to have to apply. From that point forward, any discussion with regard to the terms is going to have to be extremely, for lack of a better word, regulated in terms of our interactions with them. We expect that the RFA, the requests, the applications is going to have some clarifying language with regard to how certain things are going to be viewed and scaled in terms of the evaluation criteria. But beyond that, we don't have that sort of informal exchange from that point forward.
Okay. Yeah. You got a different subject. I don't know if you want to go on.
I'm
still on the $500
million.
Oh, I'm still on the $500 million. I haven't gotten to the $500. The administration... for the past year, all the people associated with the administration said gas is not stranded. So if the gas is not stranded, okay, just want to clarify that. And as far as the time value of money question goes,
I can imagine that Representative Dahlstrom is absolutely correct. If I were a pipeline company and the state was going to take potentially more than half the risk and I didn't have to either pay the money back, give up any equity position, at the end of the day that I still own the entire pipeline, I'll bet they like it. I mean, I'd like it too. In the comparisons, I've worked very hard at not comparing anything to the DEAD program. But since it came up, there was, in the legislature last year, there was an amendment added where all of the entities had to cough up their $300 million. So it was $1.2 billion in escrow, and if you didn't reach a gate at a certain time, the state was keeping the money. So instead of using sugar, we were using a stick to do it. To get to the open season, we were using their money, not our money. And then there was a penalty associated with that. Now, by the time that that discussion took place, it had completely imploded. But we were using, there were other ways to look at forcing things to happen other than just using the state's money and us taking the risk. Because if I were Mid-America, I'd sure like this better than not having any money. I mean, I'd do. Yeah.
Mayor, comment on that?
Brief comment. Okay.
And thank you. And I'd just like to put on record, too, that one of the companies in particular that I discussed this with is contemplating whether they would even ask for even 1 cent from the state. I mean, and I'm not going to name any names because I haven't asked permission, you know, to do so. But if one of the companies is doing that, I would assume that maybe two or three are looking at, do we even want state money? So that is out there.
And I think what's important, I mean, there's two comments on it. First off, we talk about it as if it's a $500 million spend. And we have to recognize that it's up to $500 million that the state is putting on the line and saying we're willing to go up to $500 million. And that's a statement that we don't know to what extent when the competitive nature of it comes back and the companies are saying, okay, now I want to actually get the opportunity to get in this door, and we know that the state is willing to go up to that amount. Let's sweeten our offer by not asking for all of that. And so we don't know at the end when we actually end up with a licensee if we're going to end up on the hook for that full $500 million. That'll be part of our evaluation process. But if I can pursue just the comparison that you had in terms of what if we put the money out or ask them to put all the money up and then we give them a penalty or we give them a reward for getting to a certain point, the grand dynamic that we have here. We've got the producers who we are trying to get to the table to either drive this project themselves or to participate at some point down the line. They have a significant, if not a tremendous amount of control over the ultimate success of this process. The state has an incredible amount of vested interest in seeing this project move forward without that amount of control and without a whole lot of options around to substitute for this project. The folks that we're trying to get into this process, whether it be the producers or the pipeline company, have other alternatives. They can go and look and put their money in other places. The state doesn't have those kinds of opportunities to spread our money to other projects. What we're trying to do is we're trying to create an opportunity to have as robust an opportunity for competition and, again, increase the likelihood that this project is going to move forward and ultimately succeed. And in the conversations with the people that were trying to get in that door, the state putting up a significant amount of money up front was one of those things that they said, we just need to see that. We need the state to say, yeah, we're willing to be there with you all the way through and to be basically put together through the process, to be committed to getting it through to the end. And that's what we're trying to set up here. I'm going to let Marcia add to it.
One of the things I'd like to add as well, the way companies look at this process, the process doesn't begin with the passage of a GIA. It actually is starting now, and it probably started at the end of the last attempt with the Stranded Gas Act. And and it's the competitive process, and it's what makes America great. But at the same time, what Commissioner Galvin just said, our intent is to be as broad as possible. There'll be two playing fields in which the competition happens. One is right now, in which businesses are going to try to influence and affect the playing field. And their indications of, oh, I don't need the money, you don't save your money. If we accept that and say, let's save our money and listen to a portion of the field that says they don't need it, by virtue of that act, we will have affected the competitive playing field, because there will be businesses out there who do need it, or because of their particular shareholder policies, et cetera, feel that that's in an appropriate way to do it. The second area of competition will happen after the application and the RFP process goes out. As we've indicated, while we've hardwired the 50-50 match up to open season and have identified that as a cost of about 25 to 100 million for the state, what happens after open season, we're going to be very explicit in our RFP to invite the applicants to compete with one another for the most favorable terms for the state of how that matching money gets used afterwards. The most favorable, obviously, will be a company that says, we desire $0 of your money after an open season, provided it's successful. If it's not successful, then we require the minimum amount of your money. And we would encourage companies to be cognizant that there'll be a very rampant competitive force acting on that post-open season desire for our funds.
But we don't know the criteria. We don't know. We don't know what you're going to do after a failed open season, whether it is the money makes a difference or not. It's just one of the seven. And that's, to get back to Dugan, what Representative Dugan's point has been all along. You know, if you guys are saying, well, come hell or high water, I'm going to have a third-party pipeline, then the 80% match, if the 80% match is equally as important as just having a headquarters here, which, mm-hmm. you know, just throwing up a building and putting your management team in Alaska somewhere, it is a huge discrepancy. But the bill doesn't say where the 80% match comes in. So if somebody comes in and says, I don't want your money, I'll spend my own money and I'll beat my competitors that way, and then they don't beat their competitors, we are sitting here going, you know, the trust me factor.
As I responded to Representative Dugan, I think we do need to provide you with more information on how we would apply the evaluation criteria. And I think when you get to the where that particular part of the break comes, you know, a successful open season results in this amount of money being spent by the state. An unsuccessful open season means this amount of money is going to be spent by the state, and you're in this leg of your success profile, and we're going to have to provide you with more information on that clearly, and we'll take that opportunity to bring that back to you.
Then Dugan, and then Dolster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to give you three cases here and have you tell me what the administration's view is on what this does to a GIA. And those cases are, the legislature doesn't give you the $500 million. It gives you less than the $500 million, say the $100, $150 million we've heard quoted to get to the open season. Or it requires that the state get some return for however much money it puts into this process. You know, I'm not smart enough to know what that return would be, but you know, it would end up owning something as a result of having put the money up. So can you tell me what, in your view, that each of those things does to the process that's outlined in AGIA for getting a gas pipeline?
I think the overall answer to both scenarios is that we would have significant concern that as Marcia said earlier, that by doing so we would limit the number of potential participants that we can expect to come in, because simply the state is not showing that it's willing to put a whole lot on the table to try to ultimately succeed in this process. that if we only put up $100 million or $150 million and say that's all we're willing to risk at this point, come back to us later and we'll see if we feel like it then, that the potential participants will say, look, we're not going to get into this with our money, with our $100-150 million, if at the end of that time the state's going to walk away and just cut a deal with somebody else. And so that would be one concern. And I think that's something that, as you have industry participants here before you, you can probe with them and see where they are on that issue. We came out at $500 million because that was a combination of interests. One was it was about half of what we have been told is the estimated cost of getting to a FERC certificate, so it seemed like a reasonable cost-sharing type of an arrangement. It was a substantial enough amount that it told the industry that, yes, we are in it for, we recognize the risks, we recognize how much is going to actually have to be spent in order to move this process through. We're not kidding ourselves and thinking that we can get in on a minimal amount of investment. And also, it provides an opportunity for those participants to say, okay, this is how we would propose to put that money into this process. We would put this amount of your money at the open season. We would save this amount if it's unsuccessful, and allow them to reflect back to us how they would propose the state putting this money into the process, given the opportunities that present themselves. That's going straight to that second part in terms of a guaranteed return. That's not actually putting money in at risk. I mean, that's basically telling them that we'll give you this money, we'll loan you this money, but we're not willing to risk any money on this process. And what we recognized going in is that the state has to take a little bit more of a step and say, look, we're so committed to getting this process forward, we're willing to accept some risk associated with that initial phase, and we're not going to ask you to guarantee us money back, but we expect that if we are successful, that we're going to get significant value back in the form of the low tariff and the expansion and the other provisions that we talked about before. So we're not, we think that if the state were to ask for a guaranteed return, then it's going to be much less attractive as an offer, and we will get less participation from the industry.
So you think that under any of these scenarios, you'd get less participation?
I think if we offer less money and we ask for a guaranteed return, we will get less participation.
Just one more question on the $500 million, and then I'll try and shut up. If the most important element of getting a gas pipeline built is to get the producers to commit gas at the open season so that the project can be financed, why aren't we paying the producers $500 million to make that commitment? Wouldn't that be a better investment of that money?
It would, if that would be enough. But, not doing everything compared to the previous contract, but one aspect of the previous contract that I think is illustrative to that point is that they put tremendous value, much more than $500 million, onto that contract, and we didn't get a commitment to do much of anything other than continue to study the project and move it forward, much less a commitment to actually commit gas to the project. So I think what we have to recognize is that putting $500 million in and saying we want you to commit to this project is not going to get us there. And so what we're trying to do is use that $500 million to get us something that may get them to commit, which is an actual project that has economic terms that they recognize is something that they do want to participate in.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Representative Dahlstrom, followed by Ramirez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question, Commissioner Galvin, goes back to questions by Representative Samuels. Would you be willing to commit to work with myself and whoever else on this committee that's very interested in the criteria this week, so that potentially we could come up with an amendment that we as a committee as a whole could feel good about, and let's get this, that issue taken care of right now, so we don't have to keep beating it to death. And would you be willing to commit to that?
Yes, we're committed to working with the committee on any aspect that is
okay.
of issue.
Okay, I will contact your office, and we'll set something up, and as many of us as can be there as possible, and let's get this taken care of. Thanks.
Thank you.
And that we will get to a point in this process when we will either do a committee substitute or we could
right.
take amendments to this legislation, and that's where that could be incorporated. I'm not sure when we'll get to that point. It all depends on the duration of our meetings following this,
right.
our public hearings and so forth, but I hope you get to that fairly soon.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Ramos.
Thank you. Chair McCormick, I want to thank you, first of all, just for giving us the latitude to ask questions. Since there appears to be a little lack of urgency because we're not sure when the producers are going to get their act together, even though they've had 2 months to look at this, and as Representative Dahlstrom and I were talking, time is of the essence for the state of Alaska, and we would encourage the producers to get to this committee meeting. That being said, I thank you for the latitude in asking questions, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner, I just come back to page 7 of the original presentation that you made, which nobody needs to look at, but it's just delay of 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years. It was that slide. Whether the numbers are right or wrong, whether they're stylized numbers, which is my favorite word so far that I've learned in this series of hearings, the fact is that the two commodities that are on the table are time and money. That's what I hear throughout this committee, and I thought that perhaps one of the greatest failings, apart from fiscal certainty on oil and gas on the Governor Murkowski's proposal, the other one was the uncertainty of the benefit of time spent. And so what I appreciate about this proposal is that although I have my own reservations about spending so much money, if it narrows down and makes the scope more finite for the time component, that to me is the most helpful element that's on the table, because this slide on page 7, losses to the state for each year of delay, right, is, to me, this is the story. It's $500 million versus this story. And, you know, greenhouse season is upon us. Heard a commercial for my friend, former Representative Holm, yesterday at Fairbanks, who is starting up his greenhouse operation in Fairbanks. And it's all about fertilizer. You know, fertilizer, sunshine. If you don't have enough natural sunshine, then you bring in sodium lights. You do things to accelerate the initial part of the process. And so I like the fact that this thing is time-triggered and that we are seeding or fertilizing or accelerating or expediting this process, because the loss to the state for each year of delay are so significant. We certainly studied this. Representative Samuels and I, along with the Senate, we looked at this with BP and the transmission lines and all that oil production that was lost during those few months when we had those corroded lines back in the summer, oil that will not ever be recaptured until the very end of the production life of the field. I want to start this project sooner rather than later. $500 million is a less significant cost when it is seen within that spectrum of time. And so I keep hearing that common theme here, time, money, and that we have an excellent management of time program, although with an uncertain outcome, because we don't know exactly what will happen to the open season, but we have a very prescribed methodology for getting to the open season. And the fact that there is a cost component in there, that's the trade-off for the certainty of time, is the expenditure, and I think that that's something that those of us in the private sector are very accustomed to. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Samuels?
I actually have a question.
Okay.
point taken.
Speaking of time, 2 years or 3 years, we're still waiting to hear from Mr. Hanley on my 2 to 3 year question. Failed open season. You actually design a pipeline get a FERC certificate, second failed open season. Now I have a five-year contract with my partner to get financing. Now I'm at 11 years right now, if you have a second failed open season. Is that the way that
you... Oh, 11 years at the end of the 5 years. That's what you're
saying. Well, you get 6 years, so you have your second failed open season. You got the certificate. I understand you got the certificate in your hand.
Right.
And instead of hiring welders, we're hiring lawyers. And so that, once again, I agree with Representative Ramirez. I agree with everybody in this panel. The time is of the essence. What do you do? And I don't need the answer right now, but I asked the question before, and I'm going to ask it. Representative Dugan's going to ask over and over about the criteria. I'm going to ask over and over and over again. Second failed open season, and I'm with my licensee. I'm with my partner, who has now failed me twice to get the gas. And now I am, there I am, and I'm 6 years down the road. There's a different president. There's a different Congress. There's two legislatures from now.
Mm-hmm.
There's potentially a different governor. Second failed open season. I as this process goes through, goes down, I understand this process. You're right. It gets to an open season, 36 months. Somebody's going to win the license. You're going to get to an open season. But at the end of the day, if you have a failed open season the first time, and now, and I don't want to rehash the whole thing again on who spends. But worst case scenario, we spent 80% of the money. We're halfway in, so we got a partner to the open season. Then we got 80% of the money to the certificate, and now we have a failed open season. Now we are $500 million into it, and we now have a partner that we're tied to for another 5 years. We have no gas, and you're going to make me feel a little more warm and fuzzy, and I do not need an answer now on the second failed open season. But sooner or later, I'm going to ask every hearing on what the plan is at the second failed open season, other than suing to take Prudhoe Bay away, which is, as we all know, is not where anybody wants to go.
And we'll, I won't go into, I mean, I think you identified a number of different factors when you talk about there'll be a different Congress, there'll be a different president, there'll be a different legislature.
Two legislatures.
We've got we can talk about. We can talk about the different factors that are going to come into play at that particular time, and we can talk about that at a different opportunity. But what I do want to point out when we talk about the timeline and the sense of being locked in, as it were, for 5 years beyond the FERC certificate, that the bill does provide for an opportunity for either a mutual decision to abandon the project or a unilateral decision by one of the two parties to abandon the project.
We haven't got there. I was going to ask questions about that.
Okay. But that, I mean, just jumping to that point, it's not that we ultimately, if we recognize that this licensee, this project is not going to succeed, that we have to sit around and wait for those 5 years. We do have an opportunity under the bill to say, no, this isn't going to work. It's not economic. We're going to walk away. Now, that doesn't answer the question of, well, we put $500 million in, how do we make sure that we maximize our chance of success at that point? We can talk about that in a lot more detail at a different time.
I'd like to thank Nancy for her suggestion as far as meeting with the administration and coming up with suggestions as to how we can refine this criteria. And having said that, I'd like to formalize that process, if I may, and establish a subcommittee. And if you wouldn't mind the chair of that, Nancy, I'd have you do that. I'd
be happy to.
Appoint you to chair that and appoint to, say, Representatives Dugan and Samuels and anybody else that would like to be a part of that, feel free. If you want to be a part of that too, Jay, I'd be pleased to have you on that committee. So I'd like to formally appoint those three members and encourage others who want to be involved.
I'd like to be.
Okay.
Helpful.
And I'd like to add Jay to that as well, too, and his comments, I'm sure, and input would be very helpful in that. And to task you folks to identify ways to refine the criteria, as we had talked about, and perhaps set a deadline to expedite the process here by perhaps 10 days from now, if you would prevent your recommendations to the committee, that we can perhaps parlay into a modification to the bill.
So we'll do, Mr. Chair.
I'll leave it up to you folks to decide when and where you'll meet, and if you could just report back to the committee, say in a week to 10 days, that
Thank you.
I think would be very helpful. Thank you very much for your willingness to help with that. Okay, go ahead.
Section 110. Moving on to section 120.
Oh, look, 120.
Oh, darn.
Page three.
Yes. This section relates to abandonment of the project, and subsection A relates where the commissioners and the licensee agree that the project is uneconomic. Then the inducements end, and there are no further obligations amongst the parties to one another except for the continuing obligation of the licensee to be able to demonstrate on audit that the previously expended state funds were properly expended. If only one of the two parties determines that the project is uneconomic and the other and they can't come to agreement on that process, then there'll be an impartial third party that will be requested and asked to hear evidence and make a final determination. And the process for setting up the impartial third party arbitration or determination is going to be established by regulation.
Marcia, we have a question. Representative Samuels.
Sorry. On this, you said that the two people get together and they hire an arbitrator or whatever you want to call them. Mm-hmm. And you only address if the impartial third party determines the project is uneconomic. So now my scenario is this. We've given the license to TransCanada or TransCanada Conoco Mix or TransCanada Conoco Mid-America Mix, whoever has gotten the license. And the licensee has now come to us and said the project is uneconomic. And the arbitrator agrees with the state. They said, no, it is economic. Now, our partner wants out. Our partner does not want to do business on this project anymore or doesn't want to under the license, whatever it is. What kind of a dynamic? Here we are. The arbitrator says you must do business with your partner. Can't buy him out, can't do anything. What happens in that scenario where TransCanada wants out? They say, we don't think it's economic.
Right now, the way the bill is written, the only resource that the licensee would have would essentially be to be in violation of its license, which is to progress a project in accordance with the terms of AGEA. And so it would revert probably over to Section 240, which would then give the state the authority to require the return of the license, revocation of the license, recoup state monies, et cetera.
So once again, if it's TransCanada or TransCanada producer mixer, whoever, mm-hmm. and they want out, they can get out. They can just walk away, but they have to give us everything.
Yeah, they would be in violation of the license, and technically anyone can get out if they want to assume the consequences of having violated the license.
Okay, thanks.
But the other thing, just to clarify, it also allows that damages section allows for the commissioners to seek any other remedies allowable by law that are intended to represent if we identify damages associated with their participation, if it wasn't in good faith or some other damages to the state because of their breach of the license, we can pursue that as well. It's not just they walk away scot-free. There's some other damages associated with their failure to fulfill their obligation.
Okay, thank you.
This provision also establishes that a consequence of the state's activation of the project assurances payments also constitutes an abandonment of the license at that point, so the mutual obligations of the parties would terminate upon payment of that as well.
Marshall, we have a question from Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we define uneconomic in this bill somewhere?
We do not.
Do we have a working definition of uneconomic?
I believe that most folks, when they look at a project, the commercial parties essentially have their own definition of what is uneconomic, and when they sit down to negotiate with one another and say, I believe this project's uneconomic and why, and either they come to a meeting of minds or they don't, and one aspect of not coming to a meeting of minds may be a disagreement as to whether they're perceiving uneconomic on the same grounds and terms. So presumably the impartial third party would bring to bear a commercial or industry standard. I don't know that there's such a thing as a single criteria for what is uneconomic.
Mm-hmm. Might that not be a problem in this bill? I can foresee parties who would think that if you could make a penny on 1,000 cubic feet, that might be economic, and other parties who would think that you would have to make a dollar and that if it doesn't make a dollar, it's uneconomic. So I'm wondering if you think we should have a definition in here that says what we mean when we say uneconomic.
It might be useful in terms of in the definition section if we want to attempt to address, but I would caution that we need to make sure that it is a that we can come to agreement on what we will consider, and I think it needs to be from the state's perspective what we will consider uneconomic.
Then, Mr. Chairman.
And then parties would know that going into the process that will be our standard for uneconomic.
If I remember correctly, you're a lawyer, and the last time I looked, the state had plenty of lawyers. The administration had plenty of lawyers that were working for them. Perhaps you could bring us back a definition of uneconomic.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Ramos.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that point, if I could just bring the committee back to last year, a 12% or 14% return on a pipe is terribly uneconomic for ConocoBP or Exxon, but it's remarkably economic for Mid-America or TransCanada, for those that are in the oil and gas discovery, exploration, and business. It's a lousy return on capital. For those that build pipelines and make their money that way, it's the standard, or could perhaps define the better part of their portfolio. So that was one of the problems with the Murkowski plan, is that the state kept trying to make it more economic for the producers, and that's one of my favorite elements about AGEA, is it just frames a successful pipe and allows somebody who thinks that this is an attractive, I mean, it doesn't matter how attractive a minivan is, if you're not in the market for one, it doesn't matter how good it looks, how many seats it has, how many doors that open, if it could be the Cadillac of minivans, but if you're looking for a sports car or for a four-wheel drive truck, it doesn't matter how many bells and whistles there are on a minivan, you want somebody who's going to appreciate a minivan. So when we dial into economic and non-economic, I hope we recognize that it means different things to different companies that have different capital structures and require different returns on investment for the various shareholders, since presumably every potential licensee, what we know for sure, I think, is that every potential licensee is going to be a publicly traded company. And that's, I think, a critical piece of this to bear in mind, is that the potential licensee that we have has a stated public obligation to their shareholders to maximize their return, but the notion of being economic, more economic or less economic, is relevant to the model that each of those public companies do business under.
I think that we're heading in an area that I think does need some more work to clarify, and we'll be happy to work with the committee on that. I think where for me, just sitting here thinking about it and particularly reflecting on the comments that the legislators have made, it's kind of a question whether we go to the bill setting up what the economic standard is, or whether we ask in the proposal for the company to establish what they consider the project to be economic or not, and then that would be also the deciding factor and would be part of the evaluation criteria. So we'd like to talk with the committee about that as well.
Representative Ramos?
Thanks. I think you're going to, just for the reasons Representative Ramos highlighted, you're going to find it impossible to put a definition of economic, because what's economic to Mid-America is not economic to ExxonMobil, and they will both be bidding for the same thing, so I think you'll have a difficult time. One thing that does make the thing completely and utterly uneconomic is if you have an unsuccessful open season on the second go-round. It's completely and utterly uneconomic. So, once again, my scenarios, which I mull over in my head pretty much 24 hours a day. TransCanada has the license, and either before the first open season or after the first open season, if it's unsuccessful, they come to an internal conclusion that they're not going to get a gas bid at the next one. For them now, the project is entirely uneconomic. There's absolutely, they say that nobody's going to bid on my pipeline, bid the gas. And maybe they've come to that conclusion for political reasons, but there's going to be nothing in writing, but they go, look, I don't think I'm going to get the gas I want out. So putting something in the bill that says it's uneconomic, because then your economics are going to say the math is the same, the rates of return are the same, the costs are the same, but if you don't get the bid, if you don't get the successful open season, it is entirely uneconomic. You have no return. So what are you going to do when TransCanada comes up and says it's uneconomic because I think we're not going to get the gas? And you're going to go, well, you can get out, but I'm going to sue you for all of the monies, or you're going to get out and I'm going to sue you for damages, or you must continue with me on this partnership. So kind of a variation on the same question I asked before. Your partner wants out for a reason that they can't clearly articulate, but they don't think they're going to get the gas. How are you going to deal with somebody, your partner, that you really don't even want to be your partner anymore? I suppose you could just fire them if they don't think they're going to get the gas.
Two comments. First, on the whether we can have a definition of uneconomic. We certainly can have a definition of uneconomic, and it yes. will be the one that this legislative body ultimately agrees is a good definition from the perspective of the state, and it will be the one that resides in this bill. A company will not incorporate that into their own analysis of whether to make an application based on their review of economics. It will simply be a factor that they recognize is the linchpin of whether they can walk away or not walk away at a certain point when the state's economic definition may deviate substantially or a small amount from their own internal definition of uneconomic, but they can plan on that accordingly. With respect to your second point, which is a valid one, we need to think in terms of open seasons and their failures at successive points in time, and one has to ask, why is an open season unsuccessful? And it's either going to be unsuccessful for legitimate commercial reasons, or it's going to be unsuccessful for perhaps, you know, inappropriate reasons. And, you know, one may take you down a legal path, one may take you down an abandonment path. We're not sure. But what we need to think about, again, because our perspective is what will provide the greatest sense of certainty and security to a party that's going to invest the money in this application and carry forward. We need to think about this problem from their perspective in their shoes and decide what sort of relief valves or either whether there's a mechanism in the concept of something being uneconomic or not that would address that situation. And it may have to reflect which pathway that unsuccessful open season has gone down, either for legitimate commercial reasons or some illegitimate reason.
And just when we look at the work plan that's associated with this project, we're into, as we talked before about this evaluation criteria, and we'll talk a great deal this week, the proposal is going to include the contingency plans for when certain events occur. What happens if it's an unsuccessful open season? What do we do then? And what we would expect is that there's going to be a commitment to get from point C to point D, dependent upon a fully expected and something that can be anticipated, an event that can be anticipated, unsuccessful initial open season. What I don't expect is for a proposal to come in that says if we have an unsuccessful open season, then we don't know what we're going to do then. I mean, they're going to tell us, they're going to commit to do something. Otherwise, it's not going to be a bid that we will look favorably on. And so I don't see a scenario where we have an initial unsuccessful open season and have the licensee say, well, geez, we didn't really expect this to happen. We don't see this project as really economic because we didn't get the gas this time. But I think getting to the ultimate point that Representative Samuel's getting to, if we get that FERC certificate and we have an unsuccessful open season at that point, I think we do need to have a discussion about what then. We don't see it as that we sue to take back Prudhoe Bay Gas, but we do need to have that discussion. And the sensitivity is, I mean, we're talking here about, you know, a global sort of state strategy, and I don't know if we want to do it entirely in a hearing process, but I would like to have that discussion.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I recognize, as
Representative Samuels and others have said that drawing the definition of uneconomic is going to be difficult. But the problem that I have with leaving it open is I can imagine several different things that would change the economics of the project. One is prices could go down. Another is costs could go up. And a third is that the internal economics of your licensee could change. And so it's possible to imagine a situation in which there is no definition, that your licensee comes back to you in the middle of the process and says, you know, when we told you 14% was okay with us, it's not okay with us anymore. We need 20 now, because otherwise this project isn't economic for us. So it may prove impossible to draw this, to write this definition. But I'd certainly like to see you take a shot at it and have some discussion about whether it's better, the bill's better with it than without it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I think the commissioner just brought up an important issue, too, in that if there are certain questions that we cannot, as a committee, feel satisfied with the answers that we've had, looking at the fact that the state strategy, you know, is something that may not necessarily be wise to be broadcasting to the world, you know, you might consider as a chair, if we go into executive session and discuss those those issues. Okay. But
good suggestion. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Be mindful of that, Pat, if you would, if you felt there's something that we need to discuss, you know, in a session of that nature, we'd be pleased to call on. Okay. Proceed.
Our next section is section 130, and this relates to the request for applications. You'll oftentimes hear that references RFA process. This section authorizes, actually requires the commissioners of Department of Natural Resources and Department of Revenue to issue the request for applications within 3 months of the effective date of this chapter. And these requests for applications are not going to be subject to the state procurement code. Part of that was to expedite our process, and we thank the bodies for taking into consideration the supplemental appropriation bill, which enabled us to, will enable us once it passes through the House to accelerate our contractors' work on the RFA, so that we will perhaps do this 3 months again, being mindful of time. Section 140 relates to the application requirements, and the application, the request for application under 130 will specify a substantial amount and body of what's going to be expected in the RFA process, including much of the detail around the successful state matching provisions. There will be a lot more flesh on the bones in the RFA that will guide the applicants in terms of the information that the commissioners and subsequently the legislature and the public will need to have
to be able to evaluate accurately the applications. But specifically, these items need to be included in the application, need to be met by the application. One is they need to obviously be filed by the deadline. They need to provide a detailed description of the proposed natural gas pipeline project, including its route, its receipt and delivery points, and the size and design capacity at those points, an analysis of the economic and technical viability of the application of the project, an economically and technically viable work plan, timeline, and budget for developing the project, and a very clear and explicit statement of how the applicant intends to comply with all state, federal, and international regulatory requirements. We've expanded it to international because it's we want to make sure we capture all types of applications we might receive under this in this process. We're specifically asking that if a project's going to pass through Canada, that they provide us with explicit information as to how they intend to obtain the necessary right-of-ways and authorizations in the project. We've asked for the same level of detail if the project's going to be an LNG-type project, such that we have a clear understanding of the marine transportation component, the liquefaction plant structures, ownerships. We need to be able to evaluate the viability and feasibility of any element of these in order for us to understand if the project in its entirety is going to be successful. The application must also give us some specific date benchmarks, and those are going to be, if the project's covered by the, going to be regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the application is going to have to state a date certain by which it will hold its first open season, and that date can't be any later than 36 months after the date the license is issued.
Marcia?
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, Representative Ramos has a question.
Good morning again. I'm just sitting here, I'm just mulling things over, and what you're talking about is so fascinating. It is. But here's my question with the remaining couple of minutes. Why wouldn't the producers come to an open season? I mean, we keep throwing it out there that what if they don't the first time, and God forbid, what if they don't the second time? But would somebody detail for me, why wouldn't they come to an open season if we have a license, if we have somebody who wants to build a pipe and they have the gas and we have a market, why wouldn't they come to an open season?
The key things that would cause a producer, a shipper of gas, to not want to ship their gas would be their uncertainty over how accurate the proposed tariff that's being quoted by the pipeline company is going to be. There are different ways to handle that. In kind of the older days, it was an all or nothing. Here's my tariff, sign up, and you're bound by any increase in cost over that, a cost overrun, so that it was a commitment to a potential blank check as far as not knowing what the actual ultimate cost was going to be. That process of signing on gas capacity commitments has been evolving in more modern terms, in modern times, and so now shippers are negotiating conditions attached to their commitments to buy capacity such that it starts to allocate the risk of cost overruns between itself and the pipeline companies. So it's no longer as clean a make or break point in modern times. So in terms of someone not wanting to ship, it will be because they have not been able to negotiate adequate comfort around the numbers of what the tariff is going to be for cost overruns. If a shipper looks ahead and sees a market that has a very, very volatile and uncertain commodity price, which we don't have an indication that's the case right now, but if for some reason had become that, there might be concern about commitment to purchasing capacity when they may not want to ship the actual product and sell it. Those are the key reasons why a shipper wouldn't. It would be those that would affect the profitability of their ability to sell the product.
Thank you, Marcia. Mr. Chairman, do you think that not to task Representative Dahlstrom with more work, but do you think that as we establish the criteria that we might also make an effort in working with the administration to solve for that problem so that we reduce this potential for the producers to say that they won't participate in the open season? If we can work to solve those problems in the AGEA legislation, then we reduce that uncertainty component that we addressed before. And so if Representative Dahlstrom is comfortable with taking that on as part of the work of the subcommittee, I think that might be very constructive, and it may be something that we can solve for in the legislation.
There actually is some solution. Again, we have to be mindful that private enterprise has a remarkable ability at solving its own problems. And one of the opportunities we've set up here is that if you're a shipper and you see that you have these financial benefits associated with participating in the first initial open season, those being the royalty benefits and the tax benefits, it's in your interest to ensure that that pipeline company holds its open season at a point in time when it gives the maximum amount of assurance for that shipper to be able to ship. So if a pipeline company were going to leap into an early open season just to say, what the heck, let's just test the waters, the pipeline company would be disadvantaged by not having the commitment that it would be looking for. The shippers would be disadvantaged because they would be pushed into a premature open season and eliminate the ability to take advantage of these inducements. So I believe you're going to see a level of coordination and cooperation between the producers and a pipeline company that gets selected to ensure that each side has optimized its opportunity to succeed at that initial open season.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Samuels?
Thank you. I'd make a comment on the. I agree with you wholeheartedly on the reasons that somebody may not show up at an open season. I don't think the state on a project this size is TransCanada or Enbridge or MidAmerica big enough to essentially backstop a tariff. Essentially, if worst case scenario, huge cost overruns, are they big enough as a corporate entity to backstop large tariff increases? And when the original legislation was going through Congress, there was the talk by various players, you know, and industry disagrees on what they need or don't need, that the only one actually big enough would be the United States government. So that instead of having the tariff subsidy, they put the loan guarantees, and those choices were made in Congress. But to subsidize a tariff or to subsidize the cost overruns or something, is Alaska big enough, first of all, at the with the amount of money? Is TransCanada big enough to do it? Mm-hmm. As a corporate entity, when you talk about subsidizing a tariff, where I believe your testimony was that a penny difference was $65 million over the life of the project, in my little gas 101 spiel I give, I rounded it up to 100. that's a number that I heard somewhere. So now I use 75 since I heard your presentation. For a penny difference in the tariff, it is $75 million of the life of the project. So for a dime, it's $750 million.
Well,
and for it, I mean, you can see what the money, because of the size of the project, grows exponentially. Are some of these relatively small companies, which are huge corporations, big enough to take on that additional risk? I mean, above and beyond the $500 million. You know, we're reducing their risk from the get-go for them.
And if we could just take that in different pieces. Going to the economic question of a penny tariff is worth X number of dollars, remember that the $35 million or $45 million that we had identified in those slides is the value to the state. So that's not the cost of that to a pipeline company. That's how much the lowering the tariff,
which is even more to the producer since they're over 50% of the money. The value,
well,
the value of a penny of difference.
I think you have to. What I'm suggesting is that we need to provide those numbers for discussion, as opposed to just throwing them from our slide. The ultimate question that you're asking is whether the risk sharing is a legitimate expectation, or whether it really does come down to it all being on the producers. And I think that's something that can be, again, asked of the third-party pipeline companies that will hopefully be testifying before you on this bill, is to find out how much that is a potential opportunity or not. And then connecting some of the dots that we've already identified, without getting too much of the specifics, you talked about what happens with the potential for an unsuccessful open season after open season. I mean, after getting the FERC certificate, and at that point, as Marcia said, there's still one of the reasons why there may not be participation is this perceived risk associated with either cost overruns or some other aspect of the project. And to the extent that there may be some opportunity for Congress to decide, hey, we'd like to help move this along, there's a possibility for that as well. So there's many opportunities to beat that problem. But at this point, we can't tell you what the answer is. We can talk about what the potential opportunities are. And that's the conversation that we'd like to have.
Okay. I wanted to note, just for the benefit of the committee, that we are going to go until 11:15, because we do have a floor session at 11 o'clock, so we'll be here for a little over half an hour and then conclude today's meeting and then continue with the sectional analysis tomorrow and hopefully finish it then. I wanted to also recognize Tom Irwin, who's the Commissioner of Natural Resources. Thank you, sir, for being here. Good to see you again.
Thanks.
Looking forward.
I in turn recognizing the importance of it today. This committee raced over, and I'm not even sure what my schedule is, but I know where I belong.
Well, welcome, and thanks for being here. And also, since we have been talking about FERC, I wanted to let the committee know that we do have a FERC schedule to present before the committee and to be available to answer any questions on Thursday. Thursday's meeting will be entirely devoted toward hearing what they have to say as far as the legislation, and give us a chance to ask them questions. So we have them factored into this process too. So go ahead.
Okay. An applicant that will be requiring FERC be under FERC jurisdiction, in addition to giving a date certain with binding open season, needs to commit to use the pre-filing procedures of FERC. This is being required because it greatly facilitates and speeds up the FERC certification process. In addition, they'll be required to specify that they're applying for the FERC certificate by a date certain as well. If the project is governed by RCA jurisdiction, again, they'll be required to specify a date certain for a binding open season not later than 36 months and to apply for their certificate of public convenience by a date certain as well. The applicant is going to be required in the application to commit that they will, after the first binding open season, solicit through public non-binding solicitation interest in additional capacity every 2 years. They'll be required to commit to expand the project based on two criteria, reasonable engineering increments and on commercially reasonable terms, which are defined in the statute. They'll commit that they will expand the pipeline through rolled-in rates, subject to a limitation that such roll-in rates cannot increase the cost of the expansion by more than 15% of the initial tariff rate. Anything above that 15% can be increased through either the incremental rolled-in rates.
Excuse me, Marcia. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Marcia, you may have answered this question before, and if so, I've forgotten it. How did we get the 15% figure?
The 15% was derived when there was an analysis of what the typical costs were for expansion, and looking at the scope of expansion that was on the slope, our internal economists and analysts, particularly within the DNR, looked at 15% as being one that delivered the majority of the value for the North Slope expansion, that it could fit within that envelope. In addition, related to the rolled-in rates, there's a requirement that a pipeline company not subvert that requirement by entering into negotiated rate agreements, which could contractually bypass the rolled-in rate requirement. In addition, the applicant, to the extent that they are using pre-existing owned assets that relate to the North Slope Gas Treatment Plant, and this presumably would target an application that was presented by a producers, would agree to commit the value of that gas treatment plant in the calculation of the tariff at the net book value. That cost has been depreciated by the producers and been paid through the course of other royalty and tax treatments by the state, so we didn't want to see that payment happen twice. The applicant must specify the state matching percentage that follows open season. The applicant must ensure that their capital structure for rate making, as far as what's presented to the FERC for the tariff rate making process, contains no less than 70% debt. This does not hardwire how they are actually, in fact, financing the project. The applicant needs to demonstrate what their plan is for managing cost overruns. And again, this is a critical factor because their ability to manage cost overruns will directly affect their ability to attract shippers at open season. They must have 5 delivery points. They must offer distance-sensitive rates to the delivery points in the state. They must establish a local headquarters for the project in the state. And they must commit to hire qualified residents throughout the state for the various aspects of the pipeline construction project as permitted by law. And those are the application requirements. Section 150 relates to the application review and the process for reviewing it. The commissioners will receive the applications by the date that's been set in the RFA, and they will reject any application that lacks the information that's required by the statute. And if there's additional information required by the commissioners in order to ensure that they have adequate information to evaluate on an even hand, on an even basis, all applications, they will submit the request for additional information and require the applicant to supply it, and failure to supply the additional information will enable the commissioners to reject the application as incomplete.
Mm-hmm. Representative Dugan?
Does the system for asking for additional information assume that if there are, you know, 6 applicants, that they'll all be asked for the same additional information?
it presumes that you may have that information for some applicants and are missing it from others, and in order to establish an even-handed review, I think the sense is yes, you want the same types of information so that you aren't selectively discriminating against one applicant to ask for detailed information only from it but not from others. We haven't tried to hardwire that because each of the applicants could be about vastly different projects, mm-hmm. so that the types of information we may be requesting may be irrelevant in one setting versus another setting. But the intent is not to try to, is to try to treat all applicants evenly and at a same threshold of detail to the best of our ability.
So that if two applications were to be roughly comparable, and you decided, not that one had the information that the other one didn't have, but say the commissioners decided after looking at it that they needed more information on some aspect mm-hmm. of that, the way the mechanism would work is that they would ask both of those roughly comparable. No?
The intent behind this provision is really to allow the commissioners on an application-by-application basis to have communication just with that applicant to clarify some aspect of the application in order to be able to give it full review. The time frame is such that at this point in time, the applicants don't know what other applicants have submitted, and they probably don't even know if other applications were received. This is still during that time frame where the blinds are set up to establish full competition and no competitive advantage, and it's an opportunity for the commissioners before everything's made public to say your application isn't fully fleshed out on this particular aspect. We're not sure how to evaluate it and provide that value to this particular aspect. Could you give us more information on that, and have that information presented? And when the when all of the applications are then made public, that exchange would be made public as well, and so all the questions and all the answers would all be part of the public record.
But with that said, if there's a piece of an application that requires more in-depth evaluation and it's missing from more than one application, certainly we would need to require that information from all applicants, you know, whichever one. We wouldn't selectively treat one application different than another.
Mm-hmm.
There is a provision that allows for an applicant to request that information submitted in the application be treated as proprietary or a trade secret. It is incumbent upon them to demonstrate to the satisfaction of the commissioners that said information is in fact proprietary and is a trade secret to justify its non-disclosure under 4025.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Representative Dugan.
Could you tell me how an applicant would demonstrate that?
Having been on the private sector side and having had to make this demonstration for various submissions on government contracts, you essentially have to demonstrate that either it is a non-public piece of information that is proprietary, such that to qualify as a trade secret, that it is not already out in the public sector, that it is unavailable, and that it is either qualified for protection under other state or federal laws, or where it's proprietary, it has to have a commercial sensitivity such that there would be a material disadvantage to the applicant to have that information out and available to its competitors. So it can't just be that it's something that it just doesn't want the public to know. It actually has to put it at a disadvantage in a competitive setting, and they have to make that demonstration.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The application evaluation criteria are set forth in section 170, and these include timing, the management of cost overruns, the extent to which low transportation rates are encouraged, the initial design capacity of the project, the percentage of the state's matching contribution post open season, the reasonableness, specificity, and feasibility of the work plan, timeline, and budget, the applicant's financial resources, ability to comply with the proposed schedule, their record of performance on other projects, their record of integrity and business ethics, their organization, experience, accounting and operational controls and technical skills, and their possession of the necessary assets, equipment, and manpower to achieve the project. The notice and review and comment section are set forth in section 180. Once the applications are complete and certified as complete by the commissioners, they will be published, minus the proprietary information and trade secrets. The public would have a 60-day period for public review and comment on all applications filed.
Yes, Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, could we go back to
170
for a moment? And I'm interested in performance on other projects not licensed under this chapter, and that's followed by a record of integrity and business ethics.
Mm-hmm.
If I were an oil company and say somebody got a big federal judgment against me, so 15 or 20 years ago, and I hadn't paid that judgment yet, and actually didn't show really any inclination to pay that judgment at all, would that count against me under either the first or the second of those criteria?
Oh, Representative.
No, we don't, I mean, frankly, that's not what this section is, that provision is intended to cover. That language is actually taken from the federal appropriation federal acquisition regulations, and it's just the standard clause to, as we I think discussed the last time, ensure that we don't end up in a situation where if we have somebody who has defrauded somebody in some other place that they end up with this contract and us unable to use that. We have some background information that we can provide you that goes into some more detail on that, but as far as a company that exercises legal rights to appeal, no, that's not intended to be covered by this.
So, Mr. Freeman, so this is a term of art someplace, and there's either a definition or a history that can tell us specifics of how we would be defining, say, business ethics in this?
Yes. That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dugan, I would recommend that we go over this in our subcommittee and to your satisfaction and the members on the committee and get to the bottom of it. Thanks.
Section 190 provides for the legislative process of the application review process. Once the commissioners determine that an application does in fact meet the criteria and requirements of the act, they would issue a determination with written findings and publish a notice of intent to issue the license with all of those written findings, setting forth the basis for their determination. That notice would be forwarded to the legislature. The commissioners also reserve the right, have the right under the statute, not to issue a license if they find that none of the applications meet the criteria of the act. And this decision is a final decision of the commissioners, so it would be treated as such for purposes of appeal purposes. Section 200 is what the legislature does with the commissioner's determination. Within 30 days after referral to the legislature, the legislature has the opportunity to disapprove of the notice of intent of the commissioners to approve and issue the license.
Is that in the form of a resolution?
It does state that it is in the form of the notice of intent to disapprove is by joint resolution of the legislature.
Does that carry the weight of law, say if the administration were not to accept the recommendation of the legislature?
I don't know if it itself, the joint resolution, is a law, but it certainly is the implementing act that disapproves and renders null and void the commissioner's decision.
Right.
And I think that's an issue that we can get the Department of Law to provide some information on, recognizing that we intend it to be have the effect of law and not have the governor overturn it.
Right. Representative Olson.
What happens if we receive it in the middle of a special session?
Excuse me?
What happens if we receive it in the middle of the first or second special section?
There's 30 days.
Right, we'd have to receive it on the first day, but let's say that we're...
A special session lasts for 30 days, or at least it can last. I think that's the maximum length. And so that's why this was designed with 30 days, to ensure that it could be handled within the context of a special session.
So it'd be the intent to deliver it on the first day of a special session, if that was the need?
And what would happen if it were to be delivered to the legislature within 30 days prior to the end of a regular session? Would you just call a special session, most likely, to continue it?
Yes, just to continue and ensure that there was a 30-day period.
Right. Okay.
Section 210 is certification.
I just wanted to hit on that, because one of the distinctions that I'd like to make here is that the way that this is set up, again, is intended to be simply a safety valve opportunity for the legislature to step in if the decision is that the commissioners have made a wrong decision. We do not anticipate that a special session has to be called. Just because the notice has been provided. A special session would need to be called if the legislature feels the need to act. Mm-hmm. And so to the mechanism is set up to allow for that, but it doesn't require it.
Mm-hmm. Section 210 governs what happens, what the requirements are imposed upon a licensee in the event there is a certificate ready to be issued, and the requirements imposed on that licensee relative to its requirement to move forward with sanctioning a project. If a licensee is awarded a certificate from the FERC or the RCA, it is required to accept that certificate. And the reason that section is there, it might seem obvious, well, of course you would accept it. FERC and RCA do have the ability to impose certain conditions on that certificate, and we did not want a situation where a licensee chose not to take it because they didn't like particular conditions attached to the certificate. We need that certificate accepted. Secondly, if the licensee has credit support sufficient to move forward on the project, they need to sanction the project within 1 year. If they do not have the credit support sufficient to move forward, they've got 5 years before they are required to sanction the project. If they fail to sanction the project under the conditions required in this, they're required to seek to abandon and transfer the certificate to the state or its designee, assign to the state all of its project data, engineering designs, contracts, and permits. If the failure is as a result of A or B, which is they refused to take the mm-hmm. certificate, or they had credit support and didn't do so, this is at no cost to the state.
Excuse me, Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you explain to me why the bill imagines that the license might be awarded to somebody who doesn't have the financing?
The FERC has indicated that they are willing, and in fact, under the Alaska, the federal pipeline, Alaska Pipeline Act, certain prerequisites have already been deemed accepted, that the gas is needed and the gas should be shipped. And so the FERC is required to proceed with the issuance of the certificate, notwithstanding a lack of the financial support behind the project at that time. So it would happen.
This goes to the question that Representative Samuels has, which is the question of an unsuccessful open season after the FERC certificate. What we all recognize is that the only entities that could come to the table and guarantee the full credit support would be the producers, because they have the gas and they have the opportunity to commit that gas to the line. And what we recognize through this provision in particular, that at some point along the line, we're going to have the FERC certificate in hand, and we need to know how much time are we going to give this licensee to get going on the project. If they have the full transportation commitment, if they have some other mechanism that gives them, that's why we say credit support, and we don't say if you have the gas, because the gas is the link to the credit support. Credit support is the key. If they have some other way to get that credit support, then we fully expect them to move on the project. The next question is, if they don't have that, how much time are we going to give them to get it? And again, as we mentioned earlier, It's not that we give them a blank 5 years unconditional. If we make the decision that the project's not economic, then we can cut that off earlier than that five-year period. But what this does is this tells an applicant from the get-go that as they look at their risk scenario and their opportunity to participate in this process, they're going to have somewhere in the neighborhood of a couple hundred to over $500 million of their own money in the game at that point. And they don't want to be sitting there post-certificate and have a clock that is running in a time frame that they cannot act within. And so we have a number of different dynamics that I think we're going to talk about in terms of how do you get the gas to the project, how do you get other commitments to the project if you can't get the gas, how do you get other credit support if you can't get the gas. And those need a little bit of time to come together. And the question is how much time? And we came up with 5 years, and we can have a discussion about whether that's reasonable or not.
Mm-hmm. Do you know how the Alaska Railroad plays into this as far as providing monies for the development of the line? I don't know if you remember or not, but 5 years ago the legislature did pass a bill, in fact I sponsored it, that would make up to $20 billion of tax-exempt bond monies available at a very low interest rate to companies. And perhaps you don't have a question for this, but it would be something I'd like to eventually find out as to what the criteria is that the railroad has to enable somebody to qualify or a company to qualify to access those dollars. Would you have any knowledge of that?
I don't have any current knowledge of the status of that, but I think that it does. This is the point where that becomes opportune, is what other opportunities are there for those that are interested to boost the credit of this project in order to get it over that hump, to get it actually beginning construction. Mm-hmm. And there's a number of different pieces that could play into that: state participation, a state entity participating, federal participation, consumer group participation, you know, utility group participation, all the, and then the producers and explorers. I mean, these are all the players that are going to have the opportunity to or be pushed to try to participate in this. Mm-hmm. And I think we'd like to talk about all those mm-hmm. opportunities.
Great, thank you.
Section mm-hmm. 220 deals with the amendment of or the modification of the project plan, and it can be amended with the approval of the commissioners if the amendments necessitated as a result of changed circumstances outside the licensee's control that were not reasonably foreseeable at the time the license was issued, and such amendments cannot diminish the value to the state of Alaska for the project. Section 230 details the records, reports, conditions, and audit requirements of the licensee. Section A lists essentially the audit requirements: maintenance of records, complete accurate records of expenditures, commitments of the state monies. We need to be able to track the state money and ensure it was used for the proper purposes. The state retains the right to audit the records, examine them, access them, and request copies. The commissioners as well will have a representative present at all meetings of the licensee's governing body and equity holders that relate to the project, to receive all relevant notices and information sent to equity holders, the same as if they were an equity receiver. So we've essentially, without requiring ourselves to be an equity participant, are going to receive the same level of information and access of information. The licensee is required to maintain the records for 7 years from the date that the monies for which they received the state matching funds are expended. Under Section 240, this is the license violation and damages section that we referenced earlier in our discussion. And under this, a licensee is in violation if they use state money for purposes other than those allowed under the statute, they've departed from the specifications which they set out in their application, or violated the terms of this chapter or any state or federal law material to the license, or they've violated a term of the license itself. The commissioners will give them written notice of a violation, and the parties will have 90 days to attempt to informally resolve it. The state can suspend its disbursements of state funds until that matter is resolved. If they're unable to resolve it, the commissioners will make a finding regarding the violation, and then that's an appealable decision from that point forward. if it is resolved finally that it was a violation, the state has innumerable rights relative to that violation. They can discontinue providing state funds, they can seek recoupment of funds, they can seek license revocation, and any other remedies provided at law or in equity.
Yes, Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If the license is revoked, do the provisions for the state also acquiring any work product up until that point, do they apply here as well? So you get the license back plus whatever work had been done to that point, is that correct?
That would be our intent, and it's probably subsumed under four, any other remedies provided by law or in equity.
Okay. And then could the state then just take this, whatever it is, and give it to another licensee?
Certainly. We could essentially.
So it wouldn't necessarily mean going right back to square one with the whole process?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Article 3 details the second phase of the project, which is focused instead of on the pipeline construction side, now on the shipper and inducement side. Section 300 sets up the qualification for receiving resource inducements, and that is that the person, the shipper, has to have committed to acquire firm transportation capacity at the first binding open season. Section 310 outlines the royalty inducements, and the Commissioner of Natural Resources is directed to adopt regulations that will achieve the requirements set out in subsection B. It's our intent that these requirements be fixed and locked in through contractual commitment in the lease. So these will give a high degree of fiscal certainty as a result of that. And these relate to the items we've discussed before, which is establishing the fair market value for the state royalty gas using reliable market price indices. And it also relates to the exercise of the state's right to switch between its royalty gas in value and in kind. As a condition to receiving the royalty inducements, the shipper must agree to consent not to protest the rolled-in rates. The commissioner is required by the statute to review the regulations every 2 years that set up the criteria or the boundaries for all the various royalty valuation and switching in kind benefits to ensure that they are still providing the inducements as originally outlined in the AGEA bill. And a shipper essentially has the right to opt in to these benefits if they view them at that time as being beneficial. And we would expect them to want to opt in, since that's our intent. Section 320 outlines the gas production tax exemption. And it's our intent, again, for this to be a contractual obligation. And as we described before, this is an exemption for a shipper to receive an amount that's equal to the difference between their gas production tax obligation calculated under the tax that's in effect during that current tax year and the tax that was in effect at the time of the first binding open season. And this is a benefit to be received for 10 years, during the first 10 years of commercial operation of the pipeline. And again, a condition for receiving this is to agree not to protest the rolled-in rate structure.
Mm-hmm. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've already sort of talked about the constitutionality part of this, so I won't get into that. But I'd be interested to know what the value of this tax exemption might be to the producers.
I would throw it back at you and say it's the legislature that determines the value. If there is no change in the tax structure between the open season date and whatever future tax year is in question, the value is zero. If the tax rate is increased in future years, the value of this exemption is the incremental difference between future tax rate and what it is at the time of open season.
Mr. Chairman, I think I need to ask that question better.
Okay.
What I meant was, is there a way to calculate based on, you know, some varying tax rates what the value is to the producers?
Well, what we can provide you is maybe some modeling of the sensitivity of the value to the producers of tax rate changes. And I think in the end, what you get is you have the perception of risk on the part of the producers. I think different producers are going to view that differently. Some producers are going to see Alaska as wildly unpredictable, that the tax rate could go to sky high or such things, and that this kind of certainty would provide significant value to them. Others would recognize, I think more appropriately, that Alaska is fairly stable already, and that this provides a certain margin of certainty, but that the range that Alaska probably would fall within wouldn't necessitate a huge value associated with this. But in the end, what we're trying to do is be responsive to what we're hearing from the producers in terms of their needs to get a level of certainty in terms of how much value is associated with it. It really is a matter of them providing that back to us. We don't see it personally, and from this administration, we don't see it as significantly valuable because, frankly, we see Alaska as a fairly stable tax regime. And so locking it in isn't providing all that much value because we're probably not likely to go far afield of where we are. And so it is a matter of the producer saying, we seek tremendous value in this, and we're trying to reflect that back to them. And then going back ultimately to, I think, the point that you were making at the last hearing, that value, whatever it may be, then has to be discounted by how strong you think the constitutional argument is going to be. So those things taken together will ultimately probably overwhelm any number you could come up with, and it's really going to be just a perceived risk associated with both how likely is it the legislature is going to change and how likely is this going to be constitutional.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm afraid this is another one of the many cases where, in my case, the answer was more sophisticated than the question. What I'd like to know is if the tax rate right now is, I think it's 22.5% on gas, if how much, making the assumptions that you've already made in your presentation on AGEA for the kind of pipeline you're building and the rate at which gas can be passed through it and all the rest of that, how much would 1% increase or decrease in that tax be worth? I'm simply trying to get an idea of what order of scale we're talking about.
We'll generate those numbers for you.
Section 330 of the Act has the Alaska Gasoline Inducement Act coordinator position. This again is an inducement both for the construction of the pipeline as well as the shippers. And this position is modeled after the federal coordinator position, and it's designed to be a person that will coordinate the activities of the various state agencies to ensure that the state agencies are complying with the other requirements of AGEA and coordinate with the federal coordinator. Section 340 sets out what the coordinator is going to be focused on, and that is that state agencies are going to be required to treat the pipeline and its permitting and regulatory proceedings in a manner that does not impair the project unless otherwise strictly required by law. So it's intended to confine requirements or impediments that aren't strictly required by law.
I think what we'll do, Marcia, is draw the line there on page 17. We'll continue with the rest of this at tomorrow's meeting, which is going to be in the resources room at 124. Room 124, that is, at 3 o'clock. But before we do that, though, I did have a question myself regarding 330, and that's the coordinator. Curious as to how much latitude that individual is going to have in terms of hiring individuals and what kind of I hate to use the word term bureaucracy, but what kind of bureaucracy could potentially be created from that?
I don't think we've thought beyond a single person. We have looked at what the federal coordinator person has done, and it seems to be a fairly lean and mean group, and that would be our vision here, is that it'd be a fairly tight organization.
Right. And there doesn't seem to be any limit in terms of this person's service, other than that person would serve in that position until 1 year after the commencement of the operations. I assume operations are actual gas flowing in the line?
That's correct.
So if it takes us 10, 12, 15 years for us to get to that point, is this person going to have that position for 10, 12, 15 years?
The position would be there. Whether a single individual would occupy that position throughout that whole time period would be a separate question, I'm sure.
And does that individual serve at the discretion of the governor? So if a new governor came in, that the person would be subject to that governor continuing with that individual?
It's my understanding the position would report to the governor.
Right. Okay, thank you. Representative Ellsberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You graciously gave us a schedule for Thursday, which was FERC testimony, and I know Saturday we have a joint meeting with Senate Resources. Tomorrow we have continued bill overview. What is scheduled for Wednesday and Friday?
Wednesday is actually the public hearing. That's a joint hearing with the Senate Resources Committee. They've invited us to join them, and that'll be in the Senate Finance Committee at 5:30.
Okay.
Tomorrow will be 3 o'clock in the House Resources Room. That's to continue the sectional analysis and complete that and get additional questions answered. That brings us to Thursday. That's when we'll have FERC make their presentation to us and give the committee a chance to answer any questions to them. Friday, perhaps the industry. We'll see. We're still working on that as far as encouraging them to come to us as soon as possible. And we've got Friday open for the industry to present to us. However, that may not occur until the following week. I don't know. That's still kind of up in the air. And then Saturday will be the public hearing with the Senate. It will be the second of two public hearings, a joint meeting with the Senate. What time will that be, Jim?
1 o'clock.
So maybe what I'll do, just for the benefit of the committee here, is to provide a schedule, as I've just outlined, and we'll just email it to all committee members, okay, so we have that in writing.
I appreciate that, and I'd just like to put on record, too, I'd like to encourage the producers, if there's a reason that they cannot come forward on Friday, if they could come to us and tell us why, because I know they've had this information since the middle of January, and just really want to get this project going. And so if there's legitimate reasons why we need to hold off, I personally need to know what they are.
Producers or others within the industry.
That's correct.
Going to,
that's correct.
Put forth an application.
That's
good,
correct.
Good point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. So what I'd like to do, unless there's any further questions, is just to consider this meeting closed, and we will convene again tomorrow at 3 o'clock in the House Resources Room 124. At 10:45, we are adjourned.